I'm Ann Smith. I'm the Assistant Director for Public Services with the Georgia Archives and also a member of the board of the Georgia Archives Institute. And today we're going to explore the impact of archival institutions on the American archival profession. I'm joined on the panel by Mary Reflow, Director of the Modern Archives Institute, Nancy Zimmelman, Administrator of the Western Archives Institute, and David Gracie, who is the Governor Bill Daniel Professor in Archival Enterprise at the University of Texas in Austin. And we're going, after our presentation, you will have an opportunity to have questions and comments, and we'd welcome that at the end of the session. All of our panelists have years of experience with archives institutes, including the well-established institutes such as the Modern, Georgia, and Western Archives Institutes, as well as the more recent initiatives for targeted audiences. In complementary, analytical ways, the speakers will discuss the Archives Institute's histories, their unique roles, the impact that the institutes have had on the archival profession. We'll explore why Archives Institutes continue to draw a capacity number of participants, how we can reach underserved populations, and what the role of the institutes may play in the future. The speakers will also consider the relationship between Archives Institutes and graduate education. I was pleased to be asked to participate in this session because I feel strongly that there is a role for various levels of trainings for record stewards. In addition to my work with the Georgia Archives Institute, I've also spent a significant portion of my archival career working with small historical organizations, many volunteer-run or with little or no trained staff. I've seen the impact that even minimal-level training can have on their ability to care for the records in their custody. While obviously participation in an archives institute does not make one an archivist, it does provide basic guidance that can only benefit records care. The Georgia Archives Institute just completed its 39th session with a record number of participants. And I have to confess, we realized after the institute why we didn't, usually limited. It can be very challenging to find enough internships for a large group of students. The Institute began at the Georgia Archives and has been hosted by a number of organizations over the years. But in 2003, the Institute returned home to the Georgia Archives. It's currently a two-week program with 6 days of classroom activities and 3 days of hands-on internship at one of the repositories in the metro area. Our recent principal instructor was Tim Erickson, which we're delighted to have him serving in that capacity, and previously Greg Hunter, as well as a list of distinguished individuals. A normal class is approximately 20 students. We recently had 25. At least 75% of those students are in-state, but the remaining 25% come from all over the country. Their backgrounds range from those who've suddenly been charged with records care or those who really are interested and would like to assume that responsibility. Our evaluations consistently demonstrate that the students feel the programs are worthwhile, that they will be able to apply the skills that they've learned. And an added benefit is the relationships they establish during that period with their fellow students. We've also, at the Georgia Archives, been pleased to host the HBCU, Targeted Institutes, Historically Black Colleges and Universities. This program was originally a one-year program that was funded by NEH. The grant fund for it was written by Brenda Banks, and she also served as project director and training coordinator. Because it was so successful, it ended up lasting 5 years, from 1999 to 2005. The training provided was intensive training, reaching 75 participants, which actually is reached 60% of the HBCUs in the United States, which I think is an outstanding record. There were 3 one-week sessions throughout the year of intensive training. And although I really can't tell you in great detail about the HBCU program, Brenda will answer questions later, and there is still a brochure at the diversity fair table for anyone that's interested in that particular activity. Although the Georgia Archives Institute is 39 years old, it's a mere baby compared to the Modern Archives Institute. Mary Reflow is the director of the Modern Archives Institute, and this is just one of the many hats that she wears. She's employed as an archivist by NARA, has been since 1985, beginning in the Center for Legislative Archives, working in both reference and project branches. She participated in the 2-year internal archivist training program, and she was appointed staff development officer, which included responsibility for coordination and direction of the internal archivist training program. She has served as the Modern Archives Institute director since the early 1990s, and she currently functions as senior archivist on the Access Program staff, assisting the program director with special projects and the classic other duties as assigned. So Mary is going to discuss the Modern Archives Institute, the historical and current perspectives.
Mary. Did you mention your handout?
Oh, I apologize. I'm remiss in my duties here. The handouts, just have to plug the Georgia Archives Institute. We have some brochures in the back of the room. And also, Mary's handout, I believe there are copies in the back. If you did not get one, you might want to.
It's great to see you all. Thank you for coming. Before getting started, I wanted to say that basically I have two parts to what I'm presenting. The first part is going to be sort of a historical piece on how archival education and the Institute specifically got started in this country. And then the handouts won't be until the second part where you're going to see some data and stuff. And then I'll have just a few comments right at the end. In the academic year 1938-1939, Solon J. Buck, then Director of Publications at the National Archives, taught the first formal archival course in the United States, a two-semester course on archives at Columbia University. In spring of 1938, Dr. Buck had met Ernst Posner during his two-month visit to the United States. Posner was a German archivist who was author of the first guide to the holdings of the Privy State Archives in Berlin-Dahlem, editor of a documentary series on Prussian history, and lecturer in archival administration. Despite these accomplishments, Posner was forced to leave his Privy State Archives position in 1935. Buck seemingly took Posner under his wing during his 1938 visit, briefing him on the National Archives and arranging for him to give a lecture on German archival administration in the National Archives auditorium. Columbia University chose not to continue the course on archives after that first year. Instead, American University in Washington, D.C., or AU as it is called, agreed to offer Buck's course on history and administration of archives during the 1939-1940 academic year. This time, however, Buck shared the responsibility for the course with another person, Ernst Posner, who had returned to the United States after being forced to leave Germany in 1939. That first AU course had four students taking the course for credit, and 15 others, mostly staff members at the National Archives, taking it as auditors. After the 1939-1940 course, Buck bowed out, and Posner assumed full responsibility for it, although AU's archival courses were apparently always held at the National Archives building and in cooperation with the National Archives. Posner obtained a full professorship at AU in 1945 and remained there until his retirement in 1961. I see that, and I think it's really should be full professor in 1948, not positive. No, I guess that's right. We're talking. Okay. 1945, remained there until his retirement in 1961. Excuse me. In 1945, after several years of these courses, in order to make archival training accessible to persons working in archives outside the D.C. area, Posner offered a short intensive summer institute on archival theory and techniques in cooperation with the National Archives and the Maryland Hall of Records. That was the first Modern Archives Institute, the 100th session of which has just taken place. 6 men and 14 women, including representatives of 2 academic institutions, 4 governmental agencies, 5 religious organizations, 2 historical societies, and 1 corporation, attended that first session. This rich mix of employing institution reflects every one of the institute sessions right up to the present day, and I will say that I think it is one of the factors that makes it such a remarkable learning environment. While Posner envisioned the ideal training for an American archivist to be a full academic preparation, he reported in a 1973 oral history that American University, quote, was not in a position to give me complete leeway in developing a many-faceted program of courses in archives administration, unquote. AU required instead that Posner also teach European history courses and assume administrative positions, including dean of the graduate school and director of the university's School of Social Sciences and Public Affairs. Posner reported in his oral history, quote, I would say that matters archival constituted about 15% of my work, and so I think I have not done particularly well in developing that field. My major contribution in the archival field may have been the short courses or institutes, which I tried for the first time in 1945. That, I think, was a successful venture, unquote. As he reflected in 1973 on the institutes directed by him until his 1961 retirement, and then by Frank Evans, Posner offered this assessment, quote, they have certainly contributed to acquainting great numbers of archivists and would-be archivists in all parts of the United States and Latin America with the main principles of archival administration and with the literature they should refer to if they wish to expand and intensify their knowledge, unquote. Posner also stated, quote, until more universities see fit to offer archival courses as part of their regular curriculum, much can be said for the short course or institute as an instrument for the propagation of archival theories and techniques. In terms of archival education programs, we today are far removed from 1973 when Posner made those remarks. A fair number of well-developed graduate archival education programs exist today. Yet the Modern Archives Institute, or MAI as I may refer to it, just held its 100th session. Georgia Archives Institute will hold its 40th next year, and Western Archives Institute has completed its 20th. I think this situation should give rise to a couple of interesting questions. They are, what differences are there between today's participants and those who attended in the early years? And what differences are there between current institute participants and recent graduates of archival education? Not only do these questions seem interesting, but a number of sources exist to help to explore them. First, the National Archives has certain records of the Modern Archives Institute back to the beginning, including class lists and, for many sessions, the agenda. Second, for more recent years, institute records include pre-session questionnaire summary results that are compiled as a little advanced briefing to instructors regarding the class composition. Finally, for information about recent archival education graduates, there is the recent ACE Census, by far the most comprehensive survey of the archival profession in the United States ever. And in this regard, I'd like to mention that I had access to the draft final report. I believe the final report is going to be issued in the next issue of the American Archivist. But I was on the working group that helped develop it. And also Vicki Walsh, who is the principal consultant who put together the final report, she was willing to run some queries for me against the database to hone in on exactly where the various sources would mesh, and so I'd have something comparable. Okay, so now I'm going to, now the handouts is what I'm going to move to next. I'm going to present some visual comparisons of the data in these sources that I've mentioned. In general, I will not offer analysis or suggest conclusions to be drawn from these. This will help keep the presentation within reasonable time limits. And just as importantly, I think it should make for a more interesting and open discussion by all of us later. So let me turn this on. Is it coming on? I know sometimes these come in slowly, so I don't want to. No?
Okay. Hit it, it should come up.
Okay. Is the picture coming on? Can you see? The picture's on? No, I think the lights will be fine in the end.
If you ignore it, it will behave.
Who said that? Wise. I just want to know whether to press it again.
Well, I keep working at it. The lamp is certainly on. It's not a problem of it warming up. It's not a problem of it warming up.
Okay. Is the lamp on now?
Yes.
Still?
Yep.
I haven't changed it. Input? Input one? It was already hooked up. It is something on the. Oh. Oh boy. Yeah. Let me.
I push the black screen.
Up there.
I didn't push it close enough. It's on, but not on as much as it would be. Okay, well, fortunately, here we are, 1952, the 8th session, and 2006, the 100th session. And I'd like to point out a couple of things about these pictures. And first of all, you'll see that they're in two different locations. And a couple of specific things about the black and white there, the 1952. The man in the front on the left is Ernst Posner. And also, I should mention that the man in the middle was not a member of the Modern Archives Institute. The Rose Garden is a kind of nice setting for the picture, though, I think. Okay.
Who's the man in the middle, for those who may not know?
Harry Truman.
Harry Truman.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love those spectator shoes. And Posner and Truman are setting the style there. Okay, so you all should have these copies right there. I'm just going to sort of talk through these. You'll see this is the employer. There were just a few data elements that I could compare. My first two slides here are the comparison of the early institutes with the later ones, and I can do that on two issues, one of which is employer information. Now, I use government agency, academic institution, nonprofit, and for-profit. These are that reflects the A census categories. That's why I use those particular categories. And you'll see here, and none of the above, back then, the institute, the MAI, is only open to people who actually have archival responsibilities, current archival responsibilities, but there seem to be a few people who were taking it, and maybe they would like to be, would be archivists, but they didn't currently have that. So as you see here, it's really a very even balance in both of the classes, though you'll see that academic institution takes up a smaller percentage now than was the case in the early years. The next one on academic backgrounds, The real key here is to look at the yellow. I think the yellow wedge. The yellow wedge is 5% in the early years. The first 10 institutes and the last 10 institutes is what we're looking at here. The early years, actually for academic, I only found 4 years that they actually, on the roster, there was a piece of paper in the files that I could see what their academic training was. But 5% in the yellow wedge had MLS, the library science, and you see our last 10 institutes, almost a quarter, had an MLS degree when they came to the institute, 23% there. Perhaps I should say, I meant to say on the previous one, that government, when I say government, that reflects federal, state, and local governments. So those are the two things that are just comparisons between the early and the recent institutes. And now I want to show you the gender distribution. And the reason I'm showing you this, I'll explain what all this is about after I read this paragraph from the A-Census draft final report, which says, one of the most dramatic trends documented by the A-Census is a strong gender shift in the archival profession that has occurred over the last 50 years. Overall, there are about 2 women for every man among A-Census respondents. The profile now almost exactly mirrors the proportion of men to women that Ernst Posner found in 1956. Among the newest entrants into the field, the proportion is about 4-1 women to men. So let me just explain this particular graph, and the ones that you see that are have the diagonal lines are general archival surveys that have been done over the years. The first done by in 1956 when Ernst Posner was president of the SAA, and that, as you see, has the left columns in each case are males, the right columns are females. As you see, the left column there is twice as many men as women in that. And then you go to the right column, the A census, and you'll see it's just a mirror image, as Vicki mentions in the report, twice as many women as men. In between the diagonal line, that was done by David Behrman, and he sent out to both the SAA and all the regionals. And that's more, it seems to have caught it right in the middle of the transition, 46-54%. Looking then at the other three, the purple and blue are the MAI, and the brown is recent archives grads with 10 years or less of experience, and I'll explain that in a minute. But you'll see the most interesting thing about this is our early MAI, the first 10 institutes, actually shows more like 50-50, which is rather interesting, but apparently the SAA membership was 2/3 men. And now you see the last 3 columns are all very much showing the women dominating in terms of this gender distribution. And actually recent archives grads, it's 1/4-3/4, and the other two are 2/3 and 1/3. Okay. So I told you that particular one that was about the recent archival graduate students was people who had 10 years or less of experience. And I want to explain to you what I did for the next comparisons that follow. And that is, here are the last 10 institutes. And we asked them, how long have you worked in the profession, which is something that's asked in the A-Census also. And you'll see that 2/3 of people in the institute are in the 0-3 years category of working in archives. And 87%, if you expand that out to 10 years or less of experience, would reflect the archives participants. And so I just wanted to say that because of that, the next slides are the graduate students with archival concentrations who have 10 years or less of experience. Okay, and I think this one, so there were like 3 areas I could ask about, because we asked different questions than the A-Census Act asked, but employer information here. And the most interesting part of that is clearly that 50% of people with archives concentrations are working in academic institutions. Here is the academic background. And you see the on the right, again, the archives concentration. All of them have masters, so you don't have the bachelor's portion. And you see three-quarters of them almost are from libraries, have the MLS. And then on the left, you'll see the more magenta, or those are the bachelor's degrees. But if you take out and just look at master's or above on the left side, two-thirds of people who come to the institute with master's or above are actually not MLS. They're other master's or higher degrees. And then this is one of the most striking ones, which is we have a question, are you in charge of the archives? Are work there and not in charge? And we're on the left there. You see half of our folks are in charge of their archives, whereas only 2%, now the question was, this is the one that Vicki ran for this, the question is, do you manage a program that employs archivists? And I wonder if some, you know, if this should be a little bigger figure than that, but in any case, you see the result there. So that's all of the slides I want to show. I hope this data will generate questions and comments during the discussion period. I would summarize the data in this way in terms of institute participants. Institute participants present a more heterogeneous mix in terms of both sectors of employment and academic backgrounds, while much more likely to be in charge of their archives. These factors help to explain the continued presence of the institutes in the archival education spectrum. Indeed, Tim Erickson's questions from his 1988 article remain today. Quote, what can be done about the plight of the instant archivist? These are the people who only yesterday were librarians, professors, administrative assistants, or secretaries, and who suddenly have found themselves given the responsibility to start or administer an archives, unquote. For many of these instant archivists, people who have an immediate need for broad, practical archival training, the institutes serve an essential role. I would like to end by telling you about a conversation I had years ago. I was concerned that by accepting institute participants from other federal agencies, we might inadvertently be preparing these agencies to circumvent the requirement to transfer their permanently valuable records to NARA. So, I asked Jerry Nashorn, longtime branch chief in NARA's NARA's appraisal division, if these participants concerned him. He immediately responded, no. Anytime a federal agency is willing to part with one of its staff members for 2 weeks to understand what we are all about, I think it's a good thing. In the spirit of that response, I would propose that every time an institution in any sector reaches the conclusion that its records have value and begins to take positive steps to care for them as archives, the profession as a whole benefits. It seems to me that the more people who come in contact with the archival community, the better it will be for us as a profession. This is an important part of the work of archival institutes, spreading the word and broadening our impact in society at large. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Nancy Zimmelman is the administrator of the Western Archives Institute, and like Mary, she wears many hats. She is also, she started a career as an archivist with the California State Archives in 1987. She was appointed as California's State Archivist in February of 2006. Congratulations, by the way. And she also holds an MA in history with a certificate in archives administration from Wayne State University in Detroit. She's a certified archivist and an incoming member of SAA Council. Today, Mary's going to be speaking about the Western Archives Institute, the Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists.
As soon as we get this going, why is that not answering me? Let me,
Okay, that's okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. Actually, the slide that's supposed to come up is a title slide, so if Mary is able to get it, that's fine. My presentation this afternoon, or this morning, is entitled Creating Circles of Connection, the Western Archives Institute, Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists. The circle is a reoccurring image in Native American culture. This presentation is about creating circles and coming full circle, and about circles of community, circles of professional affinities, and circles of outreach. At the Denver 2000 SAA annual meeting, a session entitled Tribal Archives at the Millennium pointed out the scarcity of education regarding tribal archives. This sparked an idea for my Nevada colleague, Susan Searcy. And at nearly the same moment, a very smart man said to me, and I quote, "Wouldn't it be great if there was a Western Archives Institute for tribal archivists?" Well, 3 years and two NHPRC grants later, 27 participants gathered at the University of Redlands in Redlands, California, for the Western Archives Institute, Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists. Now in 2006, we've come full circle, coming back to an SAA annual meeting with a report on the project and a follow-up study about the graduates of the program. The Western Archives Institute, hereafter referred to as WAI, was established in 1986 to provide an intensive introduction to the management, use, and preservation of historical records. The target audience is that group of people who have an immediate need of archival skills, but little or no opportunity to obtain graduate archival education. The Institute is an intensive 2-week program led by a principal faculty member who provides most of the instruction for the program. The principal faculty member is joined by 4 to 6 working professionals noted for their knowledge in selected areas of archival practice. Participants are selected based on the urgency of their need for immediate training. Since 1986, 625 participants have attended the Institute, representing 26 states and 7 foreign countries. The development of the WAI for Native American and Tribal Archivists involved creating a series of partnerships or interlocking circles between WAI's co-sponsors, the Society of California Archivists and the California State Archives, and with the Nevada State Library and Archives, and archivist Susan Searcy, who served as the assistant project director. It should be noted that without the contributions of the State Archives of California and Nevada, this program would not have been possible. Other co-sponsors for the program were the University of Redlands Armacost Library in Southern California and First Archivist Circle, an association of Native American archivists. Throughout the project, we relied heavily on extensive consultation with Native American subject experts and with Native American and tribal archivists who served as adjunct faculty. In May 2002, NHPRC awarded a grant of $12,305 to the Society of California Archivists for the WAI Native American and Tribal Archivists Curriculum Development Project to develop a curriculum and class schedule more relevant to Native American and Tribal Archivists training. The project modified the existing WAI curriculum, incorporating specific educational needs of Native American and tribal archivists. Project funds allowed WAI to hire an archival educator and 2 archival subject specialists familiar with the uniqueness inherent in Native American records. Timothy Erickson, then at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, was hired to develop the curriculum and schedule. Tim is an archival educator experienced in working with Native American archival workshops and mentoring programs. Catherine Jody Bolio of the Red Lakes Tribe, Tribal Archives in Red Lake, Minnesota, and Karen Underhill of Special Collections and Archives at Northern Arizona University served as archival subject specialists. In May 2003, NHPRC awarded a second grant of $42,865 to the SCA for the Western Archives Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists to organize and carry out the Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists. The University of Redlands, some 60 miles east of Los Angeles, was selected as the host site because it had previously hosted WAI and because of its proximity to transportation hubs. In addition, it was convenient to three of the four field trip locations. The process of applicant selection was of great concern to the Native American community. Our consultants, some of our consultants and others, pressed for a program reserved for Native Americans only. However, we maintained our focus on managing and preserving Native records without regard to the ethnicity of the person caring for the records, and certainly the grant requirements of non-discrimination supported this position. An additional criteria for this institute was that applicants be working with Native American or Native Hawaiian records or anticipate working with archival materials within 1 year. A total of 41 applications were received for the program. The WAI Management Committee reviewed the applications. 30 applicants received invitations to participate, 3 applicants were placed on a waiting list, and 8 applicants were not invited to participate because they were not actively working with archival material and did not anticipate working with archival material in the near future. The final enrollment list included 27 students from 11 states and Canada. The class was composed of 25 women and 2 men. The largest percentage, 29.7%, worked for tribal governments, with the second largest number working for college and university archives or tribal cultural centers. Most of the participants had high school or college associate degrees, and those with MLS, MLIS, or other master's degrees were not Native American, but were working for tribal colleges or in universities or other schools with Native Hawaiian collections. Most of the participants arrived on Sunday, July 21st. After checking into the dorm, they collected their publications and handouts. The publications consisted of Developing and Maintaining Practical Archives by Greg Hunter, several volumes from the SAA Archival Fundamentals series, Elizabeth Yackel's book, Starting in Archives, John Fleckner's manual, Native American Archives and Introduction, a publication on administration of photograph collections, and the SAA Code of Ethics. Participants were encouraged to review the publications during the program if they wished, but the publications were also intended as to be future reference tools and the core of a professional library for the participants. The first evening, after participants engaged in an icebreaker exercise, they adjourned to the terrace of the campus guest house for an informal barbecue dinner. Dr. Cliff Trafser, who is Native American and teaches Native American studies at the University of California, Riverside, arranged for local Native American bird singers, Michael and Anthony Madrigal, to present welcoming and blessing songs to the group. They also engaged in a traditional smudging ceremony to cleanse the participants and ensure a good institute. Based on a suggestion by Dr. Trafser, each participant received a small cloth bundle of tobacco. Tobacco is a traditional Native American gift of welcome, and the tobacco bundles were appreciated by all of the participants. Also, each faculty member arriving throughout the program received the same gift of welcome. After dinner, Joan Horry, a participant from Hawaii, sang 3 Hawaiian blessing songs. The program ended with additional bird songs and Native dancing by the participants. The Institute featured a combination of traditional lecture, hands-on practicum, and group discussion among the class as a whole or in small groups. There were 2 scheduled practicum sessions, one for arrangement and description, and one for preservation. Other sessions incorporated exercises and case studies, along with traditional lectures. 4 mostly day-long field trips were scheduled to the University Archives, the A.K. Smiley Public Library in Redlands, the Southwest Museum in Los Angeles, and the University of California, Riverside Special Collections Department, and the Sherman Indian High School Museum in Riverside. Specific learning goals were outlined for each visit. For example, the institutions mentioned all have Native American collections of varying kinds or illustrate different types of archival repositories. At the end of each day, participants were free to do as they wished after dinner in the dining commons. Some participants just hung out in the dorm. And one night, one of the students taught everyone how to weave a small basket. All but four of the participants stayed on campus, and as a result, many new, strong friendships were formed. On the last night, a group of participants made Indian tacos using homemade Indian fry bread. And in a very true cultural exchange, the Indian tacos were paired with Wisconsin cheese and sausage sent by Tim Erickson's wife. The last night of the program also featured a wrap-up session for the participants, administration, and faculty. Project personnel were deeply impressed by how thoroughly the group had bonded and the true camaraderie they had expressed. One student acknowledged with gratitude the participants' acceptance of the fact that the student was half Native American and half Caucasian, an issue that had caused distress and prejudice in the past. One student experienced great difficulty in getting to Redlands because of her car's mechanical problems and was grateful the way the other participants took her under their wings after her late arrival. And one student with years of experience in records management made plans with students from neighboring tribes to begin an informal class situation to help them with records management issues. A number of the participants said that they felt that the training they had received was a gift. The closing luncheon and ceremonies were held following the final class on Friday, August 1st. Each participant received a certificate, and the program concluded with songs sung by bird singer Michael Madrigal. The overall evaluations for the Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists were, on the whole, very favorable. All the evaluations indicated that the participants felt the program met or exceeded their expectations. And the most frequently repeated comment was that there was just not enough time to cover everything that was introduced. Some of the participants indicated that the program was valuable in helping them to evaluate an existing archives or records program or planned program. The participants came away from the Institute strengthened in their archival knowledge, but also strengthened by the knowledge that there are resources they could turn to for professional assistance. Strong friendships were formed. And one of the most significant statements of evaluations of the program came from a participant who said, and I quote, "We have formed a circle here that will never be broken," end quote. As a result of his experience as faculty coordinator for the 2 weeks, Tim Erickson, then incoming president of SAA, launched a personal initiative to encourage these WAI graduates to join SAA and their state archival and regional associations. He continued to encourage and welcome more Native American and tribal archivists into SAA to further the organization's diversity and to work to provide more opportunities for training and professional connections for underserved groups. To achieve that goal, Erickson appointed several new WAI graduates as members of key SAA committees, including ethics, diversity, and membership. There were a series of articles in the SAA newsletter, Archival Outlook, concerning Native American tribal issues. And Marnie Atkins, a WAI participant, was a member of the A-Census Working Group, and Native American archivists were included in that survey. At the 2004 SAA meeting in Boston, five of the graduates of the Institute participated in the session titled Native American Perspectives on the Treatment and Usage of Tribal Materials in Archives. Several WAI graduates were instrumental in forming the new Native American Archives Roundtable that has gathered here in Washington for the first time. And three of the WAI graduates are participating in session number 201 this afternoon, entitled When Technology and Traditions Collide, Respecting the Cultural Traditions of Native American Collections. The impact of this institute has been far broader than we could have originally anticipated. An unexpected achievement was to broaden participants' awareness of widely scattered collections of Native American materials held in non-Native institutions. This provided an incentive for the group as a whole to respond professionally and to work at making their own archives fully professional so they could be in a position to begin repatriation of their cultural heritage. The students learned firsthand that it is up to them as Native Americans to educate other archivists about the cultural and spiritual attributes of Native materials and that they must become joiners of professional organizations in order to move their agenda into the professional consciousness. So what's happened over the last 3 years? To assess the impact of the WAI for Native American tribal archivists, I conducted a phone or email survey July 5th through the 19th with 13 of the 27 members of the class. I also had information about 7 additional members of the class. So of the 20 people identified, 12 are still working in archives or with archival materials. The most dramatic individual benefit of participation in the program was one graduate, Brianna Lee Bob of the Coville Tribes in Nespelem, Washington, who was promoted from records technician to collections coordinator, received a salary increase, was able to rewrite her job description and the job description of the archivist position. Of the participants no longer working in archives, some had left their positions to return to school, and others took different positions within their tribal library or tribal government. In one instance, there was a change in tribal administration that resulted in the archives no longer being supported. However, as one graduate pointed out during her interview, even those not working in archives have learned the importance about archives, and they do continue to advocate about the importance of tribal archives. Assessing the impact of the WAI 3 years after the conclusion of the program, a number of the graduates indicated that their participation in the program had given them greater confidence in caring for their materials, promoting their collections, and in seeking support from other sources. Several graduates described how their collections have improved access and are better organized and described. A number of graduates commented on how the program helped them build professional connections with other tribal archivists. And some of the participants used their training to train others among their staff or within their communities. Several of the participants reported increases in donations to their collection as they raised visibility of their archives. But by far the most dramatic story of the impact on the program on an institution comes from the Agua Caliente Cultural Museum in Palm Springs, California. Ginger Ridgway, then the museum's curator, was a member of the WAI class. Over the past 3 years, Ginger was promoted to Director of Programs, overseeing the museum's library, archives, programs, and education departments. She reports that the archives has been, quote, really successful, end quote, in hiring a full-time trained archivist and processing a huge backlog of stored records. The archives has a budget for purchasing materials, and news about work of the archives has grown, generating new donations. A new cultural center is being developed by the Agua Caliente tribe that will include a new museum, library, and archives. Ridgway told me that the estimated construction cost for the new facility has increased beyond the original budget. A proposal was made to phase the building project and postpone the new library archives to the second phase. The tribal council rejected that proposal, insisting that the library and archives be included in the first phase. Ridgway has said that the archives and its collections are of very high value to the tribe, and she told me that going through WAI made her aware of where the museum needed to go with the archives, that they needed to have a trained archivist, and she created an archives department. She said, and this is her quote, "If I had not taken WAI, I would have not have been aware of the needs of the archives or what we needed to get into the archives and of what the archivist needed to function," end quote. She said that as a supervisor, attending WAI helped her provide the support that the archives needed to make it a success. Another graduate, Marnie Atkins from the Table Bluff Reservation, Wiat Tribe in Northern California, requested that there be more training programs offered to tribes for care of their collections. She suggested that this include collections in both tribal facilities and non-tribal facilities. She wrote to me, "The continuing education of tribes and institutions that hold tribal collections is imperative to the future preservation of Native American collections. The need to work together, create management plans for indigenous collections, and honor the culture the items come from, or simply repatriation of items to appropriate tribal governments or tribal museum and archival facilities are some of the most crucial components that must be addressed. While providing tremendous benefit to the participants, the Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists was very costly in terms of financial resources and the time necessary to organize the institute. Because of the NHPRC grant, participants were only required to pay their transportation cost, a departure from the traditional WAI where all costs are borne by participants. The program involved a larger number of adjunct faculty members brought in from other states because they were Native American experts in their knowledge of Native American and tribal records. In addition to the financial cost, there was cost in terms of time spent on the project by WAI administration, which included a substantial amount of preparation prior to the grant award period. It has been suggested that distance learning be developed to assist Native American and tribal archivists, but a distance learning program cannot replicate the most important element of an archives institute, the opportunity to bring people together in person. That is the greatest strength of the institute and was clearly demonstrated by the WAI for Native American and tribal archivists. The program not only brought together Native American and tribal archivists to share knowledge with each other, but it has led to collaboration, partnership, and exchange among a wider group of Native American archivists, as well as archivists from institutions with Native American collections. One of the most significant results of the Institute was how it demonstrated how an intensive program could reach an underserved population that would be unable or unlikely to pursue graduate education. Since 2003, we've been encouraging Native American and tribal archivists to attend the WAI that's offered in California. The 2006 WAI at San Diego State University included three Native American tribal archivists as participants. It is these WAI graduates that stand between preservation and destruction of a large part of their cultural record. WAI gives them not only the knowledge and skills to provide basic management of their collections, but also the resources and, in many instances, the confidence to advocate on behalf of their archives and libraries. In conclusion, the Western Archives Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists had a lasting impact on everyone who participated in the program, whether students, faculty, site visit hosts, or WAI Management Committee members. Some have described it as a life-changing experience. It also provided valuable lessons in cultural sensitivity. The graduates are sharing their knowledge within their own institutions and communities, and they are teaching the larger archival community about Native American materials and care and management of culturally sensitive items. The circles continue to grow. And I just want to take one moment to introduce Sydney Bailey, who is taking my place as the administrator of the Western Archives Institute on account of my promotion as state archivist. Sid's going to be taking over the Institute. She also has brochures for the Western Archives Institute. Thank you.
Our final speaker, David Gracie, is in a unique position to discuss Archives Institute since he is the only archival educator to have participated in all three. A certified archivist, David is the Governor Bill Daniel Professor in Archival Enterprise at the School of Information of the University of Texas at Austin. A fellow and former president of SAA, he has been teaching Archival Enterprise for 26 years, the past 20 of them full-time. In addition to the University of Texas, he has taught full courses at the University of Arizona and San Jose State University. David has served as principal instructor 12 times for the Georgia Archives Institute and 3 times for the Western. For the Modern Archives Institute, he has given the opening introduction to Archival Enterprise at least once in each of the past 21 years. David will discuss the role of the Institute in preparing individuals for participation in the world and work of Archival Enterprise.
Good morning. What do you do? What do you as an archivist do? That's the question I ask every beginning class, not to have them answer it at that moment, but rather to make them think. I ask it of new students in my graduate classes and of students in the institutes I've taught. Numbers of archivists, especially the graduate archival educators, seem to think that this is the one question, more than any other, that separates the educated from the trained. The educated, those who have been through graduate archival education, are more likely to give an answer grounded in the nature and importance of archives to society, they argue. The trained, those who've taken only institutes and only workshops, and thus whose knowledge of archival enterprise is absent such graduate courses, are more likely to answer in terms of specific archival tasks and jobs. These people, it is said, see the trees, but have little or no idea of the breadth and depth of the forest. As a graduate-level archival educator for 26 years and an instructor in archival institutes for 21, this has not been my experience. The institutes are introductions. Yes, pure and simple, nothing more. Extended introductions, but introductions. They do not bill themselves as anything other. They are intense experiences, though, with a central faculty member in curriculum ordering and relating the component topics, as opposed to continuing education in which connections between and among sessions unrelated within a curriculum, connections have to be puzzled out by the student. Characteristics of these three: having a principal faculty member and a handful of others brought in for specific topics, the Georgia and the Western. Hands-on experience beyond the classroom, Georgia, briefly, but it does. An exposure to the broadest number of students and archival institutions, the Modern Archives Institute. The environment when they began, the Modern Archives Institute, nothing else existed. Nothing. The Georgia Archives Institute, few other educational opportunities existed beyond what was available at the SAA in those days, that is, the sessions primarily. And the Georgia was begun particularly to provide education to the staff of the Georgia State Archives. The Western, the two others, could not meet the need, could not meet the demand for that kind of education. The environment now, they all continue to fill, to meet the demand. The demand has not slacked off. The students, selection. Selection is based on the students' need for archival instruction at their present position, their background. All of these are taken into account. Look at the situation in a school such as ours. We don't admit students on that basis. We admit students on other bases, not specific to their archival need. Thus, the institutes are more carefully targeted to their audience. My view on all of this is based on three propositions. Proposition one: the archival enterprise domain can never have too many archivally savvy people. Every means we have to broaden and deepen our base, we should utilize to the fullest. Talk to me, sister. Talk to me. Everyone who has been given any responsibility for archives, however minor, needs a broad introduction to archival thinking at a minimum, a broad introduction to the archival approach, methodology. And they need to have at least a basic library of resources about the work. And they need to develop a network of colleagues to consult as need be. This is the goal of any good educational enterprise. Quote, the participants came away from the institute strengthened in their archival knowledge, but also strengthened by the knowledge that there are resources they could turn to for professional assistance, Nancy told you. She could not have said it more plainly. That is a goal of the Western, the Georgia, the Modern Archives Institute, of graduate archival education, of continuing education, of all of them. As for broadening and deepening the base, quote, they have certainly contributed to acquainting great numbers of archivists and would-be archivists in all part of the United States and Latin America with the main principles of archival administration and with the literature they should refer to if they wish to expand and intensify their knowledge. Ernst Posner, as quoted by Mary, that's still the case. Quote, this is an important part of the work of archival institutes, spreading the word and broadening our impact in society at large. Mary Reflow, yes, indeed. Turn it around and look at the numbers of applicants the institutes cannot accommodate. Who is benefited by leaving these folks outside the tent? How does leaving them out strengthen the profession? That's point one. Proposition two, graduate archival education fills a critical need. So does the Archival Institute, and so do continuing education offerings. What's the difference between them? Graduate degree education, a comprehensive multiple course, curriculum organized, term long experience. An experience focused on archival enterprise, but also focused within the larger information or history domain. Continuing education, a means of keeping up to date and of extending knowledge in specific areas. Instructors normally are practitioners, not educators, and the audience is clearly defined by the topic. Each is complete in itself, and the relationship between and among any combination is the responsibility of the student, as these are not part of a larger curriculum. Institutes, they are an introduction, an extended introduction and overview of archival enterprise. It is exposure. It's not development of proficiency through substantial application. Quote, the target audience of institutes is that group of people who have an immediate need of archival skills, but little or no opportunity to obtain graduate archival education. Nancy said, this is the target indeed. Quote, Posner envisioned the ideal training for an American archivist to be a full academic preparation, Mary told you. Ideal? Amen! Increasingly, and according to the A Census, now the primary way into the archival enterprise is through graduate archival education. You bet. But archival institutes still fill a need that graduate archival education cannot meet in all instances on account of the time available to the student, on account of the cost, on account of admission requirements to get into graduate school, and on account of the level of need. The other side of the coin is institutes can be recruiting grounds for graduate archival education courses. They have been for me. Hot dog! In the American archival profession, is the American archival profession at a point, or can we even envision a point, at which either continuing education or institutes no longer will fill a need or actually will be inappropriate and detrimental to the health of the profession? Not to my mind. Proposition three. As young freshmen need to be inspired by the best minds and instructors available on their campus to motivate and inspire them to carry their studies beyond the introductory courses to the graduate level, so too, those who come to archival institutes need and deserve comparable exposure and encouragement. Common criticism of education and training below the graduate level is that those credentialed by it believe that they know more than they do. Well, the principal faculty of institutes are senior archivists, as Tim, who have knowledge to tell the students what they need to know at their point, where they are at that time, when to get consulting help, and what should be next on their agenda. The faculty are not newcomers who encourage students to believe that they know more than they know. Now, motivation comes in many forms, some particular to environments as archival institutes. Quote, the impact of this institute has been far broader than we could have originally anticipated. An unexpected achievement was to broaden participants' awareness of the widely scattered collections of Native American materials held in non-Native institutions. This provided an incentive for the group as a whole to respond professionally and to work at making their own archives fully professional, so that they could be in a position to begin repatriation of their cultural heritage, Nancy told you, an unanticipated outcome. What more could be asked of an institute? my experience with the institutes, the students are deeply committed. They come from across the board. Institute students are as motivated as any with whom I've dealt. Our master's program has gained a couple of students as a result of my speaking at the institutes, so they, many don't see it, most I'd argue, as all they ever need to know. I do teach from the same lecture notes I use in my graduate classes. Institute students do not get dumbed down second-class instruction. I have taught graduate credit courses in as little as 1 week, a shorter time than any of the institutes. I did it week before last. A real difference, then, is not the time, but rather required reading and having substantial papers required during or and or following coursework, which graduate credit courses have and institutes do not. That being true, though, I can tell you that the students in institutes I've taught have done as well or as poorly on in-class exercises as master's students at similar early stages in learning archival enterprise. So what's the bottom line? Are those who have completed the curriculum for a master's degree more fully and more deeply prepared to function as an archivist than those whose grounding has been a 2-week archival institute? Well, I hope so. But ask the person holding the credential document documenting successful completion of an archival institute and an alum of a graduate-level archival education program, what do you do? And neither of them is likely to gush, "Yesterday I didn't know what an archivist was, and today I are one." Each form of archival education makes a contribution to the spread of knowledge of archival enterprise. It is high time the focus ceased to be on one form of education in place of another and instead explored ways to harness all of those educational opportunities to the benefit and growth of our profession. So congratulations. Congratulations to the Modern Archives Institute on its 100th session. Congratulations to the Georgia Archives Institute on its 39th. And congratulations to the Western Archives Institute on its 20th, which combined represent a total of 159 sessions serving, by my calculation, roughly 3,500 individuals, which is a total equal to 3/4 of the present membership of the Society of American Archivists. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I think we really have benefited from the sermon. Oh, goodness. I feel inspired, don't you, with those of us who are participating with the institutes. We do have time for questions or comments, if you would like. Since this is being recorded, would ask you to please come to the microphone and identify yourselves and ask your question or make your comment. Someone? Okay. Yes. Well, while you're thinking about that, let me ask one of my own of the panelists. What changes, if any, do you see for your future institutes?
The Western Archives Institute has just added a session on electronic records and digital preservation.
We already have a session at the Modern Archives Institute on electronic records, and to be quite honest, I rely to a large extent on, I draw from the staff of the National Archives and from the Library of Congress. And so a few years ago, the Library of Congress started talking about EAD. And I rely on my folks, the AV guy at the National Archives recently, and also the still pictures guy, the photographic guy, added components about digital records in those two genres. You know, we try to keep that up. Always, I should say, we are, as everyone has said, a basic introduction. So we want to make sure we do not lose the focus we believe there certain things people should know that are exterior to all the ins and outs of how you operate any particular digital system.
Anyone else? Okay. I have one more. Oh, good. Yes, please.
I noticed one of you all mentioned the code of ethics. Is that something?
Can that microphone be carried to her?
She can still walk.
Okay. I'm just on your side, given the.
This is Geezer Garrison, and I'm really interested in how you introduce a subject as subtle but as critical as ethics in a fairly short time. Of all the things that I remember feeling like I was not quite as introduced to as I should have been in my institute, that was the one, that kind of professionalism. How do you cultivate that into this?
I was the one that mentioned the Code of Ethics was distributed as one of the publications to the participants in the Western Archives Institute for Native American and Tribal Archivists. And actually, I think the answer to that question is best answered by Tim Erickson, because we sent the Code of Ethics out to the participants ahead of time, and then it was, as I recall, it was referred to, incorporated into each of the sessions. Am I remembering correctly?
Yeah, I've done, I think, in fact, when I do graduate education too.
And I think I would also say, and I think Anne and Mary would probably give the same answer, is that it's just there's a certain attitude that is conveyed to the students throughout the programs as far as the professionalism and getting the message across, and then certainly with our adjunct faculty that support the principal faculty, that there's a certain message of professionalism, a tone of professionalism that is put forth throughout the program, and I would imagine the other two, Mary and Anne, would say the same thing.
At the Modern Archives Institute, we do have a special session on ethics. It's on the last day, and I team teach that myself with Walter Hill, and I really love it. And the last point that Nancy made is true. All through the course, they've been getting the sense of how a professional approaches the records and the work and the people that they deal with in the course of the work. What I do, just to be very specific about how I approach it, that particular session, I get, it's all very hands-on, it's a great joy. It's all very participatory. I get people to talk about why professions have ethics and get them to come out with, and the doctors are, of course, the do no harm is the thing that brings it most clearly into focus. What might we affect? What or who might we affect by the work we do? And then get them, once we've gotten to that point, get them to list these various things, and you begin to see that, you know, okay, you affect the donors, you are the people who created the material, you affect third parties, you affect the researchers by decisions you made, and that's just, you know, some of the people that you might affect. And so you begin to see that some of these people might have different desires as far as the work you do. You know, it's the whole access versus protection of privacy kind of thing coming up again, which of course they've heard mentioned previously. And then after we've got that sense that there are real decisions to be made, then we have about 7 case studies, and they get into groups, and then they, you know, talk a lot together among themselves about what they would do, and then we just broaden it into a big free-for-all, and we have a great time, and I think it's a very successful session.
Okay. Other questions or comments?
Oh, well, that would explain why the institutes were 50-50. Yeah, that's very interesting, Linda. I didn't know that.
Okay. Other questions or comments?
Oh. Okay. discussion about that there's a lot of applicants that are turned away every year. Has anyone kind of given thought to how we kind of take into consideration those people who can't attend the Institute? Or how we accommodate more and more people?
I'll throw that to my colleagues, given that they're involved in the position of making the choices.
Speaking for the Modern Archives Institute, two sessions is basically all our, you know, all of, I rely on the good graces and good intentions and professional responsibility of the presenters, and it's who all have other lots of other things to do. And so I don't think we can, and I'm not sure, you know, people sign up so far in advance that then there are changes, and, you know, I think it's two is the right number for us.
It does come down to a facilities issue. You know, it's how many people can the room hold, but then the other part of it is, at least for the Western Archives Institute, it also affects the quality of the program, because we so want to foster an environment where people can get to know one another, have communication with one another, really build those bonds. And when you start talking about a group, in our case, of 30 people, even that's a bit of a stretch. So if you were talking 40 or 50 people, you would lose a lot of the character. Now, in the case of the Western Archives Institute, we do generally have a waiting list. And occasionally, you know, we will have people who are initially admitted that will drop off. And so we've had years where we've exhausted our entire waiting list. In other years, I mean, we have had, just because someone is not admitted in 1 year, and it may be that they're in an institution where there are a number of other archivists, so they're not out there all by themselves not knowing what to do. So they have some support. So their urgency might not be as great in one in a given year. Well, there's nothing to say they can't apply again. And we have had people who have applied more than once and have been admitted, and it really depends on who applies and how urgent their needs are. So it would be difficult in our case. Also, we have done two institutes. We do an annual institute in California. On two occasions, in one year we've done two. And we were stretched to be able to do two in 1 year. So that's the other part of it, is it's the amount of resources available to be able to, staffing resources to be able to do more than one, as well as changing the character of the program.
I agree completely with Nancy. And there's another factor to take into account. Our ideal class is 20. This year we went to 25. And they were wonderful people, but it also really stressed the institutions that support us by providing internships. When you're looking at the institute, you're not just looking at the commitment of the host institution, of the instructors. You're looking at institutes all over the city, and they have been very gracious. But they're giving up 3 days of their time, their staff, and we all know we're overworked already, to help us with the institute. So we really cannot handle a larger group than we have and make it an effective learning experience for the student. We also can have a waiting list. The other factor in choosing the student, one of the things the student has to be willing to do is make the commitment to be there completely for the 2 weeks, to participate in their class completely, to participate in their internship. And sometimes people, for whatever reason, are not willing to make that commitment. And we cannot, therefore, admit them over a person who is willing to make that commitment, who can benefit from it.
Other questions or comments? Thank you all very much for coming, and we appreciate your attention.